I'm Emily Seiner, and this is Nashville. Today, we're talking about a topic that's near and dear to my heart, local news and public media. This has been my career for my entire adult life, and it's always occasionally useful to ask the question, what the heck is going on? The journalism industry is changing and in some cases struggling. Why should you as a news consumer care? And how do your local news outlets, including WPLN, fit into this conversation? We'll talk later this hour about some of the challenges and controversies in the national media landscape. But to start, I'm bringing in Eli Modica. Eli's a reporter for the Nashville Scene who wrote a cover story last year about the state of local media. Eli, welcome to This is Nashville.
Thanks, Emily. Glad to be here.
So I want to lay out what the media landscape looks like right now here in Nashville. We actually have quite a few outlets based here that cover local and state news. Obviously, there's Nashville Public Radio. There's also the Nashville Scene. There's the Tennessee Tribune, the Tennessean, the Nashville Banner, the Nashville Business Journal, the Nashville Post, Nashville Noticias. I'm not done. Axios Nashville, the Tennessee Lookout, the Tennessee Holler, the Tennessee Star. CityCast Nashville is about to launch here, not to mention all the local TV news, local TV news stations. So it's actually kind of an impressive list. I'm curious, Eli, how you would say your outlet, the Nashville Scene, sets itself apart from all the others on this list.
Oh, no. I can hear my editor at our office tuning in right now to just listen to my answer to this. I think we always pride ourselves on covering arts and music as well as news and also trying to retain a more voicey coverage of local politics, state politics, in the vein of a traditional alt weekly, which is, you know, what our print edition and what our like brand is, you know, an alternative weekly publication that publishes all over the board, everything that's going on in Nashville, things to do. Our critics pick section in Vienna is one of our recent hires that I mentioned in the cover story that we hired from the Tennessean. And like his whole job is just to figure out what's going on, edit critics picks, and keep sort of an arts voice. So I think the arts coverage, the little more irreverent news coverage is kind of what our brand is, and music, of course, and in Music City. It's one of the things that we love to cover. There's just so much going on.
Yeah, I love the critics picks. I use that often to plan out my weeks. That also, I think, lends the scene to being particularly suited to be a, kind of a media watcher. So I want to talk about your article from last year. It was called Good News, Bad News, The State of Nashville's Media Landscape. What do you feel like you were trying to say about what's good and what's bad in Nashville news? Maybe we can start with what was the good news?
The good news is that so many amazing outlets are opening. So many new voices are coming on our radio waves, and also, you know, and new bylines are gracing our print and online publications that, like you mentioned, CityCast and the Nashville Banner are recreating, in the case of the Banner, but creating and coming to town, creating their publication in the terms of CityCast. The blossoming, I think about it like an ecosystem. I think I used that word at least once in the article. There are ways that we cross-pollinate, that we make each other better, that we compete for stories, and all of that is good for writers. I know I love that, to get the feeling that Stephen Elliott, my former colleague now at the Banner, is covering some of the same beats as me. I want to be able to write in a way that, you know, gets different angles from him, adds to the reporting. That competition, that cross-pollination, all those things are exciting parts of Nashville's media landscape. And then I assume the next question is about the bad part.
Yes. What's the bad news?
People leave and outlets shrink and they get things wrong, or they lose credibility with their audience. And those things are emotionally hard and just practically hard, I think, on the city to see. I think I talked a little bit with some of your reporters at WPLN about the big voices and the connection between the voice and, you know, whether you're sitting alone in your car or alone in your kitchen, you feel really connected to the voice coming through in your radio. So when we lose people like Sergio Martinez Beltran, sometimes we still get to hear nationally, which is amazing. Samantha Max, those can feel like, they are losses, and they can feel sad. And, you know, it's hard to lose institutional knowledge from people who retire or move away, like Natalie Allison, Joey Garrison, two big reporters at Tennessean who left to cover national outlets. But also it is we're in careers as journalists, and you know, Nashville can be a stepping stone for some people. And whether it's pay, cost of living, family issues, or you know, wanting to be closer to family, or all sorts of considerations also weigh into your job to leave the city too. So that's the sad thing. And of course, the Tennessean is a big focus of the article because it's really our flagship publication here. And the Tennessean, through corporate consolidation and Gannett coming in and closing, consolidating, changing its coverage, that is a loss to us. You can think back, well, I can't because I was born in 1995, but many people that I talked to for the article can think back to times during the 60s, 70s, 80s, particularly under the leadership of John Siegenthaler, when the Tennessean was really a paper of envy for a lot of journalists and readers around the world.
Do you think that what you're describing as like people moving, cost of living going up, pay not being great, the major paper, you know, falling victim to some corporate consolidation decisions, is that in your sense of the media industry, is that unique to Nashville, or is this something that's happening in every city?
It's happening all across the country. I can't name them off the top of my head, but there are multiple huge efforts, nonprofits dedicated to fixing news deserts and bringing news to CityCast, I think, is one of them. It's bringing especially local reporting to people across the country, because really outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, they've definitely, in the case of the Times, they've grown and they've added writers, and specifically the Times cooking section and game section. Like, they've adapted as a business and stayed profitable. That's not the case for most papers like the Jackson Sun or the Tennessean. Even those are papers that close. Papers in smaller towns and rural areas, those are papers that gradually lose writers and lose money, and then they close. And that's the far more common story.
Yeah. You leveled a certain amount of criticism in your article. You said, you know, about the Tennessean and about some other outlets too. What kind of response did you get from local journalists?
Holly McCall is one of the people that Holly was the first editor in Nashville to accept a pitch of mine and helped me as a younger writer 4 or 5 years ago. And I interviewed her for this article. She's now at the top of the Tennessee Lookout, and she's built that into a really formidable, specifically with its state capitol reporting outlet. Holly said that she does not criticize reporters publicly. And I think that her quote in this piece is something that I want to also like abide, because there are so few of us, and we need to maintain a certain amount of respect for the journalists around this city who are working really hard in making good faith effort to report. So the response that I got was not direct, not explicit, but I know WPLN, I think I had a line about them struggling to retain staff. I see that as a fact, and I have, you know, examples of that in there. Same thing with Tennessean, struggling to keep people specifically between career steps, early career to mid-career, mid-career to late career. So to the extent that I leveled criticism, I think most of it was very factual events that have taken place, and I don't think many people can test those facts. I think there were some cases that I maybe got some names or some dates or times wrong, and you know, so I heard from some outlets about, you know, specifically how many months people were here, when they got here, or when they left. And so that's something that we always want to correct and get right. But people didn't tell me that I said things that were wrong, because I didn't. So, yeah.
you described kind of this pattern with like smaller papers like the Jackson Sun of losing talent, the paper shrinking. The other component of that is audience and people deciding not to subscribe anymore. And it's kind of this chicken and egg thing of like, you lose some big names or familiar voices of reporters, and then people cancel their subscriptions because they're not getting as much out of it. But how much responsibility does the Nashville audience have for the shrinking of some of these larger outlets?
That's a good question. It's hard for me as a writer and as someone who's part of an outlet, like a for-profit outlet, to blame the audience for behavior. Like I see it more as just like a challenge or something to adapt to. It's not necessarily someone's fault that they can't or don't elect to make donations to outlets that are nonprofits or buy sometimes expensive subscriptions. I understand it was much more of a norm to, you know, when daily papers were delivered to pay for that. And I think also people paid for a better product when they were paying for the Tennessean on their doorstep 30 years ago when the newsroom was bigger and the reporting was more in depth. So, like you said, chicken and egg. Are outlets consolidating because audiences aren't paying them enough money to stay afloat or to grow or the other way around? It's doesn't really matter whose fault it is. Like, you don't blame the chicken or the egg. You have to have a clear-eyed view of what's going on in order to fix it or adapt to it or move forward. And I think the banners model, I don't know how CityCast is funded. I think it's some rich people or, you know, some large donors or people who are willing to take losses, which is the case for the scene. We have a wealthy owner, the Freeman family, and they're willing to take losses, and they do. And it keeps us, and we stay in business and stay afloat and keep producing with very limited. I know that Bill Freeman publishes a letter in our issues. Beyond that, I don't hear from him. We don't hear from him. So each outlet has to navigate these financial considerations like WPLN. A piece of which can be audience shrinking. But again, nonprofit outlets have found ways to adapt to that. So I don't want to blame the audience or Nashville for any behavior. I want to turn the spotlight on news, how we can keep generating it sustainably.
Yeah, I appreciate you thinking through that. So what can news outlets, what do you think news outlets should be doing differently in Nashville?
I think we should be paying writers more, paying you and I more. It's really hard to live in the city and to report on a city when you physically struggle to make ends meet. I don't know what like a WPLN starting salary is. I don't know what a scene starting salary is these days, but it's below the area median income. I can say that comfortably. So paying and nourishing and nurturing reporters from their early career to their mid-career and mid-career to late career so that we don't see people when they want to make that next step like Joey Garrison or Natalie Allison or Samantha Mex, so that we don't see them looking other places and leaving. We want them to be able to get that same support and do that same work here. And I think that does come down to like, you know, professional considerations. So we should be supporting our writers, paying our writers, and we should be doing great reporting, which, you know, all of us strive to do.
I'm with you on that. Eli, thank you so much for joining us and for your work in local news. We'll be right back. And when we return, we're going to talk about the elephant in the room on this public media giving day, and really all days, which is money. Stay with us. I'm Emily Siner, and this is Nashville. We're talking today about the chaotic state of the journalism industry and turning the mic around to see where Nashville Public Radio fits into all of it. If you are even remotely paying attention to news about the news in recent months, you've heard about layoffs. So many organizations have cut staff, citing financial pressures, including several large public radio stations across the country: Colorado Public Radio in Denver, WAMU in DC, WBEZ in Chicago, WBUR in Boston. That's just from the past month or two. This means that these employees typically get a certain amount of severance pay and benefits, but lose their jobs. I know this well. I myself was working at WNYC last year on a podcast there when the station canceled several shows and laid off our whole teams. It was not fun. So to help us make sense of what the heck is going on, we've got Mac Linebaugh, WPLN's Vice President of Audience Engagement, We also have Jesse Dukes, a freelance audio producer and former WBEZ staffer. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jesse, you left WBEZ before the most recent round of layoffs, but I'm sure you still talk to a lot of people there. Can you describe what it feels like to work in public radio at this time and see layoff announcement after layoff announcement coming down the pike?
Terrible. It feels awful. You know, it's heartbreaking. I know many friends and also people who I might not know as friends, but maybe I, you know, have met once or twice or know by reputation who I really admire, who have lost their jobs. And it's that part of it is awful. It also feels like some of it might be avoidable. In the last few weeks since the layoffs happened at WBEZ, I mean, you also missed KCRW in that litany of recent layoffs that you gave. I think they had a bunch of layoffs recently in Los Angeles. It's led me to try to make some sense of it and pay a little bit more attention to some of the industry trends, both in public media and also in podcasting. I kind of feel like with podcasting and public media, there's sort of been maybe a double bubble and now a double contraction. So yeah, it's bad.
Yeah, I want to come back to that idea a little bit later about, you know, the trend and whether it's necessary. But, you know, one of the core issues with all these layoffs is money, and every station is choosing to deal with it in different ways. But many stations are having financial issues. Mac, can you explain the basic funding model of public radio member stations? Like,
sure.
How does this model work?
It feels like I should be doing a pitch break right now. I think this is an misunderstood thing that, you know, like people are used to the way other sort of media conglomerates work. Like if there's NBC has stations around, like outlets around the country, and there's sort of a top-down, you know, management. And here, this NPR was created by member stations. Ours was one of the charter stations, and we went on the air in 1962, and we're 10 years old when we joined with other stations to create NPR as a way for us to sort of share things. And all of the money that, well, there's maybe some exceptions to that lately, but most of the money that NPR receives comes through member stations like ours. So we pay a certain fee to air All Things Considered and Morning Edition and this whole slate of other programs. We also pay fees to American Public Media and to PRX and other distributors like WNYC in order to air their programs. And then we go out into our community and raise the funds. And there's a very small portion that comes from the federal government, which I think is about 4% in our most recent budget. And we also have business underwriting. And so the vast majority of our support comes from our community, and that a lot of that goes on up to NPR.
So how would you explain the financial strain that the industry is feeling right now?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I'm an observer in this much like you, and I feel like I could be asking you this question too. I mean, there are certain things that we know, and one of the things is that COVID really changed the way that people interact with radio. So much of the radio listening that happens in cars. And we see that in our own sort of numbers. The people tuning into Morning Edition and All Things Considered are there are two most popular shows, and they happen during drive time. People have them on during their cars. People's habits really changed during COVID, and that hasn't really, you know, those habits haven't really changed back in a lot of ways. And I think also there was a lot during COVID, there was a lot of stations getting some of that, I don't know, is it called PPP money? These grants that sort of like enabled, there was sort of a short-term infusion. And a lot of those kind of ran dry around the same time that there was audience declining. So, you know, it's been surprising to me. I think there are a bunch of other stations you could have mentioned. This is happening to a lot of stations, and especially large stations, I believe.
Yeah. And then also, I mean, with podcasting, a big part of that was sponsorship money drying up and kind of what Jesse's describing as this double bubble.
Right. The double bubble, which sounds like chewing gum, but it's really the perfect phrase to describe this.
Jesse, given these financial pressures, do you ultimately think that some of these layoffs were inevitable or even necessary? Or it sounds like you think that some of them could have been avoided.
It's hard to know. It's really hard to know the answer to that question. I mean, at WBEZ, where I know the most, I will just say, as a nonprofit, I don't find WBEZ to have been very transparent about its operating finances. You know, they're a nonprofit, so they publish the Form 990. But when you hear the CEO talk about revenue and those sorts of things, it's not really reflected in the 990. So they're, they're releasing the bare minimum of information, but we don't really know how the money is being spent. Some people have suggested that some of it's avoidable because the C-suite salaries are too high. And I certainly think that might be part of the problem. I don't think it's the core problem. I mean, when you lose when you're down to 2/3 of the audience in public radio listening, which is what the New York Times reported recently, sort of across the system wide, you're going to lose revenue. And I think, in addition to the other factors we talked about, I also think there was a real dip in charitable giving around the time of COVID, just because there was an economic crisis as well. So there was that piece of the pie. I don't think there was any way to avoid stations losing a lot of money. They probably could have avoided some of the layoffs. I think the thing that has me upset and frustrated was the choice at WBEZ and some other places to just basically eliminate the podcast department. Also at WBEZ, the sort of community radio service Vocalo, which I don't know as much about. I personally find that short-sighted because I think what feels like is happening is a lot of the core public radio listeners are still, they still like the content, they still like the programming, they're just finding it digitally, either as podcasts or reading articles. And so to me, podcasts have a huge potential for retaining the public media audience, and people love local podcasts. I mean, you have some great local podcasts in Nashville, and WBEZ was finding some success with that, not enough money to not enough listenership to necessarily generate, the costs of production through ad revenue. That's really hard to do with podcasts, and it's getting even harder. So I imagine that there would be economic woes no matter what, but maybe the degree of damage might be avoidable.
And you're saying that the decisions that they're making, that some of these stations are making, could just lead to further damage?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think in the case of WBEZ, what it seems clear is that they're prioritizing the news gathering operation. And there was a recent merger and acquisition with the Chicago Sun-Times, the newspaper. And so they've merged those newsrooms. And it seems like where they are expecting to see their growth might be in digital articles, as opposed to podcasts or as opposed to Vocalo. So I guess that's a strategy, So when they had to do layoffs, the thing they cut were the podcasts. And so to me, it seems like they're abandoning that particular strategy. And yeah, I don't know if I agree with that. I think we've seen some other public radio stations. I can think about KQED, I think, in San Francisco, and also Vermont Public Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio. I don't know about your station. I know you have a lot of podcasts. I don't know how they're doing. That have had a lot of success kind of meeting that audience that has left the radio in the podcasting space, and are, finding that audience there, growing that audience there. Again, they're probably not generating enough ad revenue to pay for those podcasts, but they're, it is a synergetic effect. They're helping the organization. And that's kind of where I wish WBEZ was putting their resources. And that's what I find frustrating.
If you're just tuning in, this is Nashville, and I'm your host, Emily Seiner. We're talking this hour about some of the challenges facing the news industry. Mac, I want to ask you about Nashville Public Radio's finances. What kind of financial strains are we feeling?
Can I just piggyback on that just for a second?
Yes.
And then I'll sort of get to that. I'm not trying to avoid this question as much as I would love to. But I think that's a really interesting point, you know, I was just thinking of two different stations that we've sort of been watching, and one of them is WAMU, who's been such a flagship station in the system for such a long time, and had a history of really sort of being digital innovators, I think, over the last 10 or 20 years. You know, they have recently decided that they also had this online news publication called the DCist. They've closed that down. They've eliminated, my understanding is that they're down to something like 4 reporters or something like that. And they're putting all of their resources into audio and into radio, which seems to me to be a really counterintuitive thing to do. And then there's another station out in LA, KPCC, that has recently rebranded itself as LAist. And they have also had to do layoffs, but they have really sort of done this around positioning themselves for digital. I think it is absolutely difficult to, at this point, to figure out how to monetize the podcast. And, you know, like traditionally in podcast ad revenue, it's like you've got to be having, you know, a minimum of like 100,000 downloads or something per episode in order to be able to sort of monetize that with some of these, you know, we've all heard the Squarespaces and these advertisers that are so common on public radio. But like, I feel like you've got to figure out a way to sort of be there where the audience wants you to be, or you're going to have no opportunity to monetize that.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my soapbox about that. I am not one of the station finance people. It has been like a really sort of scary thing to sit back, and it feels like every week there's a news story about another one of these giant public radio stations that are going through massive layoffs. We, you know, 2 years ago had a pretty large deficit. This fiscal year that we're currently in, we have managed to shrink that deficit by about half, if I understand correctly, and we're sort of moving things in the right direction. But, you know, we went a really long time without having deficits at all. You know, we are not in any sort of immediate emergency, but things are tight and fund drives are not doing what they used to do. And, you know, some of the, you know, we used to be in a position where we controlled the pipes to National Public Radio, and everyone had to get the programming through us, and our fund drives were just sort of a heyday. And that time has really passed, I think.
People can still give at WPLN.org.
But remember, it always used to be, this is the only place on your dial that you can find, you know, Fresh Air and Car
right.
Talk. And you know, I remember hearing that messaging back in 2005 or 2006 when podcasts were new, and thinking, you know, what's going to happen when people figure out that you can listen to those shows, you know, over your computer. They didn't have, we didn't have iPhones then, but we had iPods and you could stream them. And that has happened.
Yeah.
True.
You want to say something?
I would love to.
Okay.
I mean, I think there is a silver lining to this potentially, which I know during a time like this, it's like, that's an eye-rolly thing to say. But, you know, the flip side of us being in where we are is that we have to provide more for our local audience. We have to provide more local, even hyper-local service to our audience. We didn't used to have to do that. And so in some cases we didn't, you know, our newsroom has grown a lot. We do have more podcasts. We do have all these digital products now. We're covering more beats, and that's because we recognize that we will be judged for the value that we, WPLN, brings to our audience more than ever, and not as much for what NPR is bringing that audience.
You know, every time there are these big layoffs, I inevitably get an email from my dad who's like, should you still be in this industry? And to some extent, I feel like there have always been these boom and bust cycles within journalism. I guess I'm wondering, for both of you, like, is this moment unique? And what gives you hope? What would you tell my dad about why I'm still here? Jesse, do you want to start?
Sure. I think the double bubble nature feels a little bit unique. You know, it's like two hurricanes in a row, you know, that, and that, the, you know, that one bubble there was what you might call the stupid money era of podcasting, where you had venture capital, Hollywood, and a lot of for-profit companies investing in podcasts, trying to make hits, thinking they were going to make a lot of money. And then, you know, after 5 or 6 years, realizing even if their podcasts were making money, and even if they were profitable, they weren't making the kinds of profits that the venture capitalists wanted, or they weren't generating the kind of intellectual property. So that happening at the same time as this decline in public radio listenership on the radio, I should say, terrestrial radio, I think there might still be some total growth overall. That feels maybe unique. I think that there's reasons to be hopeful. I do think that, you know, that one of the things that's true is that the public radio newsrooms often are the best investigative newsrooms in a city these days, you know, and that was not probably true 20 or 30 years ago because of all that growth we had. So we have great reporting. We have great producers. Podcasting is growing. Of course, there are also probably too many podcasts. I think that's part of the problem. It's a very saturated market, but there is growth. So it does feel like there's opportunity. And I think the other thing, as I'm a podcast guy, you know, I'm a podcast producer, podcast editor. I like podcasts. I think that if people understand that launching a podcast, whether you're a public radio station or maybe some other kind of institution, if you think that very quickly you're going to have a hit and it's going to make you a lot of money, you probably shouldn't do it, but that there are other reasons to invest in podcasting that are synergetic with your mission or with your other activities. And I think maybe when some institutions figure that out, some of the jobs will start coming back and there will be a positive correction. But, you know, it's going to be tough for a while, I think. But hopefully we start seeing a positive trend soon.
Mac, in just like 15 seconds, what gives you hope?
Sorry, I went long.
Well, what gives me hope, I think, more than anything, are the people who work in this building and the kind of work that they're doing. I'm very inspired by it. There's an audience need being met there, and I think that we will figure out a way to pay for that.
We have to take a short break. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us. Mac, you'll be on some more. When we come back, we'll talk about another piece of the national landscape, which is NPR, the network, and the fallout from recent accusations that it's become too liberal. We'll be right back.
You're married in crisis. Well, you are not alone. No need to know the reason why your family not together. Spare me all the details.
I'm Emily Siner, and this is Nashville. Today is Public Media Giving Day. We've been talking about what's going on with public and local media here in Nashville and around the country. As we just discussed, finances play a role in what's going on in media right now. Journalism is also heavily impacted by politics of the places that we're reporting on and of the people who are doing the reporting. That's at the core of a recent essay written in the Free Press by former NPR senior business editor Uri Berliner. He describes the typical NPR listener as an EV-driving, Wordle-playing, tote-bag-carrying coastal elite. We still have Mac Linebaugh, Vice President of Audience Engagement at WPLN with us. Mac, I want to know if you feel like that assessment is true.
Well, you know, I think we've come a long way from Volvos and tote bags. So
we skipped right past Subaru.
That's right. I hope it's not. I think, honestly, I think that when we have an audience that is kind of changing, it gives us an opportunity to reach an audience that that looks more like all of America, which I hope is what Alicia is going to talk about.
Well, so yes, I want to bring in Alicia Montgomery, who's the vice president of audio at Slate and was at NPR for many years. Alicia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you spent a significant portion of your career at NPR. How would you describe the culture of doing journalism there?
Cautious, for good reasons and for not so good reasons. I think that the network always struggled with how we, I was there for about 20 years. The network always struggled with how to sort of speak to what individual member stations needed. And we know that those stations, you know, WNYC and WAMU, huge institutional power, really large and highly supportive listener base. And then stations in teeny tiny towns all across the country and in red states and blue states before they were called red and blue. NPR needed to be a provider for that wide variety of needs, also needed to speak with a core listenership that was always, if not sort of the economic elite at all times, but was sort of an elite group of people a lot of times when it came to education and social position, and then also had to stay on the right side of an often hostile and not necessarily fair Congress. And so there was always a tension about how best to do that and to carry out this mission, which is, you know, nonprofit journalism, which is supposed to be the kind of reporting that won't necessarily get a lot of corporate support and funding from people in power.
Mm. Well, so for those of you listening who haven't read the essay, Uri Berliner basically writes that he believes NPR has lost its way. Here's a clip from an interview he did with Chris Cuomo.
So for those who are sitting there saying, I knew it, NPR, those laconic lefties, you know, with that slow delivery and just feeding us all of this, are you saying that's the truth, or are you saying it's something that has evolved? What do you want people to feel about NPR and what you feel about the media in general?
I think it's evolved. You know, I've been at NPR a long time, 25 years. You could say I'm a lifer. And it's a place I've always loved working. But when I started, there was a liberal orientation, but I think we were more guided by curiosity, open-mindedness. You know, you said, talked about policy. We were kind of nerdy and really like to dig into things and understand the complexity of things. That I think that's evolved over the years into a much narrower kind of niche thinking, a group think that's really clustered around very selective progressive views that don't allow enough air, enough spaciousness to consider all kinds of perspectives.
Alicia, when you first read the essay that he's referring to here, like, what was your initial reaction to his comments?
I was mad. Uri and I were never buddies or anything like that, but you know, we worked in the same space. NPR can be like sort of a small town. I felt like a big chunk of his criticism of the organization just didn't match the facts of what was happening. And because it was a narrative that was useful to people who were always trying to discredit NPR because of some kind of perception of the politics of the people who worked there, that it just fed into that and it oversimplified what's really a complex situation. And it kind of, you know, I know that slander has a very specific meaning, so I don't want to use that term exactly, but it misrepresented the work of hundreds of people, you know, journalists and folks who support journalists inside that headquarters, and then the thousands of people across the public radio system. So I, you know, it's not that I don't think NPR should be criticized. I just want to see that handled fairly.
Well, let's talk about the work a little bit. One of the accusations that Berliner levels at NPR is that reporters and editors intentionally avoided certain stories because they didn't line up with their worldview. So whether that was about Trump or Biden or even COVID, you wrote a rebuttal for Slate that said you saw no evidence of this. And in fact, sometimes you saw the opposite. Tell us a little bit more about what you saw.
Okay. So, I mean, everyone here on this this conversation, knows how newsrooms work. And there are few resources, and you're making hard decisions all the time about what stories get covered. It's not one of those things. It's not the Daily Planet or the Daily Bugle or any other sort of superhero comic book vision of what a newsroom is. People are not following up on tough stories all the time just because the resources aren't there. But at NPR, there was also kind of a layer of establishment thinking. It, you know, you don't want to sort of challenge some of the perceived desires or perceived worldviews of the listenership and the part of the listenership that was really valued, which was this, you know, I call it the Seven Sisters slant, which is it's the Northeast corridor, it's highly educated, it values the arts, it's center left, it prizes politeness and civility, sometimes even above sort of the hard truths that you're supposed to deliver as journalism, as journalists. And so anything that challenged that particular worldview, whether that it was sort of skewed to the left or, and I don't want to say to the right, but it's like toward the establishment, then those stories were deprioritized.
So it sounds like you're saying that what you were, maybe the change that Uri says he's observing is less that it's just become more progressive and more that the correct me if I'm wrong, but like NPR is continuing to kind of follow the lead of other major news organizations in the Northeast. And that has been the same fault over the years.
Yes. I mean, the thing that I wrote about where people would come to the meetings with really great, strong, original story ideas and be put off and put off and put off. And then the story would appear in the New York Times and all of a sudden, you know, editors would greenlight it. That's something that was happening at NPR for years. I started a little bit a couple of years before Uri, although I did not start in the newsroom. This whole golden age of NPR that he talks about, it's like even back then, people were still in the late 90s, people were talking about the golden age of NPR being in the rearview mirror. And, you know, so that felt very in keeping with, you know, the constant refrain at NPR that things were always better, you know, 5 years before, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And this kind of critique is not really anything new.
If you're just tuning in, this is Nashville, and I'm your host, Emily Siner. We're talking this hour about the recent debate over NPR's political leanings sparked by a critique from former editor Uri Berliner. Mac, I think what has really riled people up is that Berliner linked these alleged violations of journalistic integrity to the fact that NPR has prioritized diversity in recent years. He points to things like tracking the diversity of your sources, doing unconscious bias training, trying to diversify your staff, even having affinity groups for people of shared backgrounds. And his take is that all of these things quash debate within the newsroom. What do you make of that?
I cannot speak to this in the same way that Alicia can. And Alicia, I've just been reading your piece just right before we went on the air. I started reading your response to Uri's piece, and I recommend it to anybody. It's in Slate. I think that that legacy audience, when he's talking about sort of like this, the good old days, you know, I think that there is an acknowledgement at NPR that we have this, you said it yourself, like the EV or the Volvos, the Subarus, like that's a thing that I think that NPR has really been trying to sort of get over its past of sort of representing and reflecting this one segment of society and really trying to sort of open up its coverage and to all and to hear from diverse voices. I too share the concern about, you know, conservative voices being represented on WPLN or NPR. But boy, I felt like his examples, when I looked through them, are just like, you know, I'm not coming from inside the newsroom, but when I see, you know, the examples of Hunter Biden's laptop, which was like a story that I thought all news outlets were really careful about in the early going, except those who sort of had, you know, a dog in that fight. Like we want there to be something to this. Mm-hmm. And that's an area where NPR proceeded with caution. So I just felt like, you know, not having the same kind of insight to the inner workings that Alicia has, the examples that he gave really sort of were hollow to me.
Yeah. Well, I do want to ask Alicia a little bit about the diversity initiatives, because we've seen so many newsrooms take on these initiatives, especially since 2020. And what was interesting to me about this essay was that it kind of explicitly coalesced some of the backlash that I've heard bubbling inside newsrooms, especially among white editors. So I guess, Alicia, like, how do you feel about these initiatives? What is working and what is not working?
Oh, gosh. You know, I was on just about every committee to expand NPR's voice that they had. And I found, again, that was kind of a fact-challenged thing, because that initiative about sort of cataloging who's who and who we're talking with was something that happened, I think, the first I remember sort of having that solid conversation was in 2016, 2017 inside the newsroom. And I think that I remember some of those meetings. We discovered that we thought that we had greater diversity than we did. And so because we're journalists, we wanted to collect information about what we were, the range of people who were represented on the air. That was something, if Lansing sort of supercharged that, it was something that was, you know, an initiative that was started years and years before. I think that a big problem with diversity initiatives in newsrooms is that they're very reactive. You know, George Floyd is murdered. Suddenly, you know, you have this influx of journalists of color, and they're being brought into the same newsrooms that never attracted journalists of color in the first place, without any kind of real cultural change that's happening on the inside. And I say that about journalists of color. One of the things that I agreed with Uri about, you know, even in our shared time together at NPR, was there wasn't enough regional diversity. There wasn't enough socioeconomic diversity. There wasn't enough diversity, yes, of opinion, but just about sort of life experience. Because, you know, the country is not affluent, coastal, college educated as a default experience. That's not the country that we were supposed to be covering. And so it shouldn't just be about racial diversity or diversity around these kind of hot button identity groups. It needs to be sort of a broader effort and a lasting.
Yeah. Uri wrote about how NPR's listenership has become more polarized. He place the blame on NPR's coverage, but the entire country and so many institutions within the country have become more polarized. So I guess I'm wondering, Mac, just to wrap it up, like, where do we go from here? What is public media's responsibility to address divisions, differences?
Oh, I wish you had asked Alicia that question. you know, I mean, I think that a big part of the polarization, to me, this is my armchair theory, is that has a lot to do with local media sort of going away. And so, like, people, even in rural areas, are, like, gravitating towards big national outlets, and that are sort of pushing the kind of divisions and selling ads on the divisions. And whereas if they had a lot of local coverage, they would care more about the specific issues in their areas. So I feel like that's where we got to focus.
Alicia Montgomery and Mac Linebaugh, thank you so much. It's so important to have news organizations who reflect on their own work. And I should add that if you too want to be a tote bag carrying NPR listener, you can get a This Is Nashville tote bag by donating $10 a month. Thanks for sharing that at This Is Nashville producers. So you can donate to WPLN at WPLN.org. Thanks for tuning in this hour. This Is Nashville is a production of Nashville Public Radio. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Burton. It was directed by Tasha A.F. Lumley. Our board operator is Liv Lombardi. Our theme music is by LaRange and Namir Blade. Special thanks to Mary Mancini and Char Dastin. Listen back anytime at thisisnashville.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Nashville. I'm Emily Seiner. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.